right. I want you to hold on to your video things right now because I want you to look over them and chat with me about it. You watched four lectures. One of them was over literal and figurative. One of them was over structure. One of them was over rapture. And one of them was over application? I don't remember. What was the fourth one? There's four. Rapture, literal, last days. Is it? Okay.
Structure.
We're living the last days.
Okay. So, any of them, what I want you to do right now is just, if you had questions, let's talk about them. If you just had something that just kind of struck you and you just wanted to kind of say it out loud, because, you know, that's kind of interesting, and just for all of us to maybe share it if somebody fell asleep during half the lectures, say it. I want you just kind of reflect on the four videos, because those I would have loved to have been able to do live, but, well, we just don't have all kinds of time. So, anybody can go. There's no structure on this. And I will sit here for at least 15 minutes if no one talks. So just let you know.
Where did you find the information on the history of rapture? Was it in a specific book?
There are some books. There is a book. Oh, I don't want to get this one wrong. There's a book called The Secret Rapture. No. McPherson.
You mentioned The Great Cover-Up.
The Incredible Cover-Up. Yeah, that's one of them. I've got several books in my office. The one though, if you wrote it in your notes, where I actually get the letter from Margaret MacDonald, is the one that I found to be the most helpful. And I believe that is called The Incredible Cover-Up, or is that what I said? The Great Cover-Up or The Incredible Cover-Up?
I think it's The Incredible. Yeah.
The Incredible Cover-Up. Yeah, and it's actually got a guy on the front going like this, and he's going like that. Yeah, that one in particular. To be honest with you, the history in and of itself is not as easily explained. He is the one that pioneers the tracing it back to Margaret MacDonald. Some people have challenged that theory, but nevertheless, I found his argument to be the most convincing about bringing it back to Margaret MacDonald. Other people stop at John Nelson Darby, but we don't have evidence of him completely fabricating it. We just have evidence of that he got it from somewhere. And the fact that this letter exists, and we do know that Darby was in the presence of Margaret MacDonald whenever she did the fever-induced prophetic trance, leads me to think that she would be the impetus of this. But no one goes back behind 1800, historically speaking. And the way in which you trace it, I'm even tracing it the way in which several things. Some of the information comes from just different articles here and there. So this is the way a lot of history works. When you're trying to piece together the tracing of an idea or an event throughout history, you have to kind of figure out who was speaking about it when and were there interactions with other people that were speaking about it later. And that's kind of what I did more on my own and even with discussions with Dr. Lowry himself about his study on the rapture. And so that's where I developed that history. As far as that's concerned. So, which, you know, all the interactions. There is one other guy I've discovered that I think strengthens the connection between Cyrus Schofield and Darby. But I don't remember his name right now. So don't act like that it's just like this guy said it to this guy and then that guy said it. No history works like that. No spread of an idea. We can't trace it that exact. You have to trace it with circles that overlap. I mean, and the fact of the matter is, Darby was in connection with Cyrus Schofield Reference Bible. I mean, how many people were influenced by that? I mean, hello. It was one of the most important Bibles of the earliest 20th century. But then Dwight L. Moody, how many people were influenced by Dwight L. Moody? Hello. He's one of the most amazing evangelists in the 20th century, even somebody that I think maybe per capita would put even Billy Graham to shame. I mean, Dwight L. Moody was amazing. How many people have been influenced by the Moody Bible Institute? You see what I mean? So when you're tracing the history of an idea, you just have to see wherever circles overlap. And that gives me, it doesn't give me certainty, it gives me a plausible probability. Does that make sense? Yeah, because we do know that, you know, Billy Graham did graduate from the Moody Bible Institute. That's just truth. I mean, you can go and look at the registrar and maybe even get his grades released if FERPA allows you. But anyway, and how many have been influenced by him? You see how this works? And that's how you kind of have to trace this. We do know John Dellison Darby came to the States 6 different times. He was the one that created a movement that's called the Plymouth Brethren, who were also big in pushing the rapture as well. And they are still in existence today. Yep. Good question. Yep.
You had those 3 major texts about the rapture. Are there any like minor texts? Mm-hmm.
They find it under every rock, if I'm being honest. But those are the 3 big ones. But you saw it with Revelation 4:1.
Yeah.
I mean, really? That's one of the, I mean, the in the, whatever, one of the guys I quoted in there who says, this is the clearest reference to the rapture in the entire Bible. And I'm like, really? Why would you say that about this text? I would have said it definitely about 1 Thessalonians 4 if I was going to say about anything. Or Matthew 30, you know, Matthew 24, 36 and following. But Revelation 4:1, but you know, I can't change his opinion. I can just laugh at it, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, or just kind of just really just kind of say, I don't understand how this is clear to you. Well, and that even goes back to the Fuller quote that I brought out, where Fuller on the radio program says, in the Bible, there is absolutely no biblical evidence for the rapture, but I still believe it. And that's whenever I just say, you know, we have a problem. We have a problem, because if that's the way this game plays, well then, I can make up anything I want. It doesn't matter if it's in the Bible, I still believe it. Well, who cares if you believe it? That's my response to him. I'm not worried about what you believe. I'm worried about what the Bible says. Because you know what? David Koresh didn't find everything that he was saying in the Bible, but he still believed it. So should I have been in Waco? No, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't care what you believe. What does the Bible say? I don't know. Anyway, what else?
I have a question, and it may be really silly.
No.
Like, it deals more with like Christ coming back.
Absolutely.
Obviously, at least most of us are in agreement that he comes back to deal with the evil first.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really.
What's going on? Where do we go? Like, how he protected Noah's ark and everything? Are we going to be in an ark? Like, I mean, maybe I'm the dumb one in the room, but.
No. Can I answer that question with absolute certainty? No. But I do have a couple of biblical strands that I can take out. Okay. Number one, he does in 1 Thessalonians 4 say that we will be caught up with him in the air. So it's not like that, you know, whenever he comes back that we're either going to have to pick the earth or somewhere else to stand. Like, well, we have to run around the fire that's conflagrating, you know. Which is one of the reasons why I think 1 Thessalonians 4 does fit with the conflagration of the earth that's described in the Petrine epistles and even Revelation. Well, not necessarily Revelation, but the same linguistic parallel. So that's a possible strand. Where are we? We'll be with Jesus. That's one of the things I can say with certainty. What will we be doing? Paul seems to mention that we will be a part of even judging the angels. Will we be... I'll be honest with you, in Revelation, this is what's interesting with Revelation, is that people that are Christians in Revelation never stand before a judgment throne in Revelation. We never are. That there is no mention... At the great white throne judgment, Revelation chapter 20, 11 through 15, that's reserved for the evil. It's very clear. Because there's only one judgment in that scene, and it's, you're all going to burn. Mm-hmm. Paul does mention it in 1 Corinthians 6, when he's talking about, why are you allowing people that is outside of the church to judge settlements, lawsuits between each other? He says, don't you know that we will even judge the angels? And you're going, what does that mean? I don't know. I really don't know. Bottom line is... there'll be things for us to do, and I have trajectories, but I have nothing conclusive. Does that make sense? That's the best, again, because I'm more interested in
right.
in what the Bible's pointing me towards. Those are that is as close as I can come to an answer. Yeah.
You said that one of the problems you had with the rapture was that it's an American theology.
Mm-hmm.
Did it have any spread throughout Europe since it originated in Europe? Or?
This is interesting. Okay, this phenomenon has been actually, over the past 5 years or so, it's been very interesting, because what I'm finding is especially a lot of African countries now, because of Western missionaries coming and saying this is the way it is. Some of them I find very passionate about dispensationalism. Very passionate. Because they function in their society based off of honor and shame. And the one that brought them the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, they will not contradict. Therefore, if he says there's a rapture, there is one. Even if it makes absolutely no sociological sense when they look around them, I shouldn't say no sociological sense because I'm making a sociological argument. It doesn't make a sense in the sense of looking around them and seeing is there a tribulation or not. But what it does show is that there, and sociologically their honor is attached to that. Europe, this is funny. I was shocked by this. Whenever I was over in Scotland last fall, not this past fall, but the one before, doing my PhD stuff, I wrote my first chapter on just kind of laying the terrain of the history of the study of Revelation in the past, 300 years or so. And in that, I had about 15 to 20 pages just on the rapture theology, the different millennial positions that have really kind of taken root, the different literature that they've put out, and where they're headed. And then I moved on, was talking about how in the past, 25 years, 100 years ago, people were really obsessed with historical intricacies like Ramsey and Colin Hemer. Last 25 years, it's been Old Testament allusions, and then we'll talk. We can talk about where I want it to go in the future. But point is all that, is whenever I turned in my first chapter, the one thing my advisor said was, cut out all the stuff about the millennial stuff. And I said, what? And she goes, you can cut out that. She's like, no one around here even gives that a second glance. And I said, well, that's refreshing. she said, everyone here believes that that Revelation has a historical background. She said, "You won't find these wacky theories really here at all." She said, "So since you're writing for a UK audience, just cut it out." I was like, "Really?" And then when I had to defend a year later my idea before the panel, one of the head of the program, Larry Hurtado, told me, he said, "I don't want to see any Tim LaHaye or any Volvard, any of that in your bibliography because it's just." We consider them on the fringe, the extreme, and my context was totally blown because I'm going, well, my word, that's like around every corner where I live, but where it just never really took root. It never took root in where Darby came from, which is maybe the reason why he kept coming over here. It just never did. And what's interesting was the church I went to whenever I was in Scotland was a church that was planted by Dwight L. Moody, and they didn't preach it. Actually. First Sunday I was there, they had a guest preacher from Dallas Theological Seminary that came in there to preach, and he found it in the parable, but everybody else was kind of like, what? That's the only time I heard it. And it was because somebody from America had come to talk about it. Well, he wasn't even supposed to talk about it, but he came in and talked about it anyway. All that to say, no, UK, it really isn't. But, they've been around a little longer, and there's something to be said about wisdom of a country that comes with age.
Is it also possibly because of the whole Catholic origin?
Possibly. But that'd be more Italy. UK is more Anglican than they are Catholic. And Anglicans have a pretty, they have a strong, obviously, Catholic connection in the sense of their more liturgical connections, but. That's possible. It's possible. Catholics, they don't buy into this at all. I have a book written by a Catholic scholar called "Will Catholics Be Left Behind?" And he's basically just saying this doesn't make sense with any of the history of the church that has ever come out. So why in the world would we buy into this? That's pretty much the conclusion of his book. Which I'll be honest with you. One of the weaknesses of our movement is we don't know what the people before us are speaking. If I'm being flat out honest, one of the major weaknesses is we do not pay attention to church history enough. And a lot of the debates and a lot of the things we beat people over the head with, if we would just read what the first 300 years of people were saying, we'd realize what we were allowed to beat people with and what we weren't allowed to. But we don't pay attention to what they said. It doesn't matter. So we take the Bible and we abuse it however we want. Whenever I'm going, those early voices should be guides for us. It's called a cloud of witnesses. And the Catholics really do that well. And we should take notice of that. And we should we should follow their example, because they'll give us a more balanced perspective of a lot of these issues that seem really big, but in the grand scheme of the history of the church, they're foolish. If I can use that stronger language. Yeah, Natalia.
In your rapture lecture, you're saying this is an American phenomenon because people don't like to be uncomfortable and they feel like right now the tribulation hasn't started.
Yeah, it's very convenient. Yes.
Can't you argue that, I mean, persecution isn't always just a gun to your face. Could mm-hmm. persecution, like in America, I find like a type of persecution we have here is like excess of like materialism mm-hmm. and being able to resist that. So it's not a form of like seductive culture as well. It's not a form of like, could that be biblically a persecution when we're kind of like, we're in such excess that we're like suffering slow death of the soul.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with you 100%. But the people that are describing it, they don't see our comfort as a persecution. They see it as a blessing. So even that theology in and of itself plays into this. Because I do agree. I do think that we parallel ought to say more than anything. We're walking a very dangerous line. Hence the passage that you guys just wrote out today. Hello. You're neither cold nor hot. You're lukewarm. I want to convulsively vomit you out of my mouth. So says the Greek word for spit. Really? That's how they're going to translate that? But yeah, you're exactly right. We are in very dangerous persecution. Hence the reason why I'm saying it doesn't matter. I agree. It doesn't matter if you have a gun pointing to your head. This is the tribulation. This is the persecution. The reality is that what should be the most deadly persecution, we've changed in our vernacular to one of the things that God's given us as a blessing. Well, that's even really more convenient. Then I never have to deal with the rich young ruler passage. I can make as much money as I want and just be happy-go-lucky. But bottom line is, a blessing can become a curse really quick if it's not used for the kingdom. And America will have to give, I believe, America will have to give an account for what we've done with the riches that we have. Now, who is giving them to us depends on how they're used, is where I would say. Bottom line is, if somebody's dying with their money, I'd say, yeah, Satan probably wants you to have more. If somebody's pouring their money into the least of these and taking care of the needs, I'd say, yeah, God probably is blessing you. Blessing or a curse? I don't know. How are you going to use it? Then I can tell you. So, it's very convenient if we look at our comfort as a blessing from God to say that He wants to perpetuate that with the rapture theology. Because whenever our comfort is going to be threatened, our material is going to be threatened, we get taken out of Dodge, we get to go up to heaven and hang out and get more comfort and riches. Wow, that's awesome. Man, that's selling a lot of books. Get more money and then the whole cycle just goes over again. No, I agree with you 100% that we are enduring a very dangerous persecution. But what this theology does is it preserves what is killing us. Hence the reason why I'm very passionately outspoken against it. Because of what it is doing to the church as a whole. It is not helping us. It is not drawing us closer to the red letters. It is pushing us further into the abyss that we think is the home we deserve. Yeah, other thoughts, sorry. You black out, then you come back, and you're like, where am I at? You know, anyway. What else? Low sugar? I'm just kidding.
What are, and I guess this is kind of a mix between two sessions, but just from the conversation I had with my pastor back home, like, mm-hmm. what are some of the major arguments for like the Jewish idea of recapitulation and people taking the propheticness of Revelation as a recapitulation, saying this is that, and using that and interpreting the, I guess, prophecies of Revelation? Does that make sense?
Keep talking. I don't know if I've got a grasp yet.
Like if you were to say like why can't if in like the apostles' day after the resurrection the Jews were able to say look these are the fulfillments of that through Christ now, why would today's Christians not be able to say, look, these are the fulfillments of John's prophecies now?
Yeah.
Like in the recapitulation of the cycle, what are some of the arguments against that?
This is kind of dealing with the question that David had before. Regarding how come I can't do with Revelation what they did with the prophecies of Joel and Amos. And my response to that is a couple fold. Number one, when were they doing that?
After
it happened. Their perspective is a little different. Mm-hmm. They're not prognosticating, they're prescribing. They're not saying, this will happen in the future. They say, look what's happening right now.
But how is that
totally different?
Is that different than what, like, if they were to say, look at what's happening in Egypt, or look mm-hmm. what's happening in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
That is this, like, it's already happening. How is that different? Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of. But what I'm saying is that the hermeneutical methodology that we're wanting to do by taking Revelation in one hand and newspaper in another is not the hermeneutical methodology that the apostles were implementing. Mm-hmm. We think they're the same. We think even whenever Matthew says the word fulfilled, that it is defined in the sense of this was predicted. But it's not. He uses the word fulfillment to even talk about typology, which has nothing to do with prediction. It has everything to do with the fact that this is the thing. When you're a Jew, you believe the way that God moves throughout history is cyclically. Therefore, the things that look like Israel back here, it makes sense that they look like Jesus up here because that's the way he moves. He moves like this. So whenever he says, this is out of Egypt I called my son, this happened to fulfill what the prophet said, out of Egypt I called my son. That wasn't a prediction about Jesus. Even the word fulfilled, I challenge, I say, how do you define fulfilled? What does that mean? Because we're thinking through a hermeneutical methodology of A equals B, that A is fulfilled by B. That's not even the way the word fulfilled is used throughout Matthew. Just do a word study on it. And it's not always the same. Does he do that sometimes? Yeah, he does. But even when he does it, sometimes I'm uncomfortable with it. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. And the virgin will be with child. Ooh, that's not what Isaiah was talking about. Was it? Was Isaiah talking about that? Go back to Isaiah's context. Was he telling the king that the way that they will know that they are not going to be destroyed is whenever a virgin, somebody that has not had a baby or has not had sexual intercourse, will have a baby? That's whenever they will know in Isaiah's time? No. What was he talking about? A young woman. Because that's the way the Hebrew word. Now, Matthew comes and says, but this is also this is fulfilled with Jesus too. Why? Because he flips it on his head. The word fulfilled doesn't always mean fulfilled. Just like the word forever doesn't always mean forever. My word, this class is going to take forever. That isn't what the word really means in that context, does it? Even in the Bible, look up the word forever. It doesn't always mean forever the way we want it to mean forever. Because language doesn't work that way. So, my response is this when it comes to Revelation. Number one, I believe you are changing the hermeneutical methodology with which the apostles were implementing what you were claiming that they're implementing. They are not doing what you're saying they were doing. You're assuming that they are because you think you've defined the words accurately that I'm challenging that whether or not you know the definition of it all. Second, I have no evidence that this is the way in which Revelation needs to be interpreted. The only reason why you're doing that is because you don't understand what it is saying otherwise. Because also you have a misdefinition of the word prophecy. You think it must equal prediction, which we've already talked about that as well. And the third reason why is the only thing I can do is tell you what it said to them then, but I have no idea if this is going to be, if we're going to get on the other side of heaven and be like, it did work out that way. Because that's the perspective that even the gospel writers were writing from. And when we get that place on the other side of heaven, we look back, maybe we will be able to make some connections of Revelation that I don't have the privilege of making right now. And as a result of all of that, it seems very dangerous to me then to start making solid prognostications of the way in which the world's going to end, trying to match it up with a book that I think is answering totally different questions than what you're even putting on it. So is it possible that Revelation is laying out the way everything is? Sure. Is it probable? Not at all. See what I mean by that? Can I say with absolute certainty that it won't have any sort of future fulfillment at all? No, I can't say with absolute certainty. Because I wouldn't have been able to say that absolute certainty about some of the things that Matthew said with absolute certainty was for being fulfilled. But certainty doesn't equal... Well, I can't say that statement. At that point, there's as many interpretations as there are people, and I'm not comfortable with that. Because here's my question. The Rapture Index, which you can go to online, there's a Rapture Index that gives you a number that tells you how close the Rapture is based on events. Whenever Hurricane Katrina occurred, it went up quite significantly. Here's what's interesting. Dr. Lowry at that time was over in Vienna teaching Revelation at Haus Edelweiss. Throughout that whole, you know, 3-week period when he got back, he didn't even know Hurricane Katrina happened. So what events are actually being fulfilled depends on which newspapers you're reading. Because Hurricane Katrina didn't even make press overseas. So how can I take into the account all the events that are happening over there as well? We think that we have this constant, clear picture of the way in which the world works because we're in such an information age, and yet WikiLeaks has shown us, actually, there's a whole other bunch of information you really don't know about. Oh, well, some of those may have been really important for us to know when the rapture was going to happen. But what I'm saying is to be able to look at the Bible and try to predict that stuff before it even happens, you'd have to be able to look at the whole picture, and we can't. We can only see from the context in which we have. Therefore, it's really easy for me to pick and choose what I want from the headlines and make them equal stuff. But at that point, like I said, there's as many interpretations as there are people. I'm not comfortable with that. Some people are, fine. Fine. But the conclusions that people have come to, here's my question. How many times can we get the prediction of the second coming wrong before people finally turn us off about the first coming? I wouldn't believe in all the yahoos if I was on the outside. I'm going, you morons have predicted Jesus coming back so many times and he hasn't. I have a book sitting on my desk right now that somebody sent me anonymously. I don't know who it was. But it's called God's Witness 2008. And this guy claims to be God's witness as a prophet under the lineage of Abraham on the back of the book. And his whole argument was, as he was writing in 2003 or something along those lines, that the world's going to end in 2008. And this whole book is predicting that. And guess what? That dude's a dime a dozen. And I have a website that, in my notes, you can email me for it, that is a non-Christian that has listed all the predictions of Christians that have not come true. And at the end he says, and this is why I think they're all a bunch full of crap. And you know what? Can't blame him. And where in the Bible are we supposed to be predicting about the second coming? I thought about times and dates, 1 Thessalonians 5, that we shouldn't worry about, because we know it's going to come like a thief. I'm sorry, what somebody desires to do with the Bible, I am not convinced of when it goes against all the imagery that is used to describe the event that they're wanting to predict. I mean, my word, how many times does he need to say, it's coming like a thief, it's coming like a thief, it's coming like a thief? Well, but we can still predict it. Like, at that point, I would just be like, okay, you're not even listening to me. So just do what you want then. I have no desire to do something that I feel like the Bible clearly is saying, don't. There's no point in it. The one thing I can tell you about predictions is that they've all been wrong so far. That's what they all have in common. They've all been wrong. Jack Van Impe, before he died not too long ago, I think it was Impe, claimed that the 1988. 88 reasons why the rapture will happen in 1988. Didn't happen. 89 reasons why it'll happen in 1989. Convenient. But what happened was everybody got on the bandwagon. All the prophecy experts. What it takes to get that title, I don't know. I guess I can just turn over on the other side of the bed and I'm a prophecy expert. And it doesn't matter how many I get wrong, I can still be one. That's awesome. Well, my goodness. Whenever... Because the reason why 1988 was so important, I don't know if I'd said this in any of the lectures you were listening to, but Israel was created as a nation in 1948. And Jesus says, within this generation, Matthew chapter 24, and they said generation, 40 years. Because that is what scholars have said generation is. Well, 1988 came and passed, and guess what Hal Lindsey and Jack Van Impe and Tim LaHaye says now? Well, a generation can be anywhere from 40 to 120 years. That's convenient, because whenever you're long dead and gone, then you get proved wrong. Wow! At that point, my word, I can sell anything! All I have to do is just say, well, you know, the world is going to end in 2112. Buy my books. It's impossible. I mean, so in other words, what I'm saying is let's judge it by its fruit. Is the practice possible? Sure. Is it healthy? Far from it. Because it's done nothing but cause fear, frenzy, bad theology, borderline heresy, and false predictions. Sorry. I don't want that. I don't want that on my rap sheet. I don't want it. I don't want to try to convince people they'll have a second chance within their lifetime because the rapture is happening soon. I don't want it. I know a guy that one of his good friends said that he refused to totally commit to Jesus because he wants to be left with the rapture so he can help people. That's what we're producing? What is wrong with us? When will we finally just stop and say, let's see if this really makes sense fruit-wise. How are we supposed to judge false prophets? By their fruit. What would they do with false prophets in the Old Testament? Why? Because if you're claiming to speak from the voice of God and you're speaking lies, it reflects on Him. And these people can do false prophecy after false prophecy. And they still can be claiming to be prophets of God? I'm sorry. But that is damnable to me. That frustrates me because they're hurting my witness. Because selling Jesus to someone that looks at a bunch of morons that get the second coming wrong is a little harder when we're predicting it every other day. This is not what we're supposed to be spending our time doing. We're supposed to be spending our time dying for the least of these. Spreading the gospel as far and as wide as we can. A gospel of hope, not one of fear. A gospel that exalts what Jesus did on the cross, not denigrate it by saying the Old Testament system will have to be implemented once the tribulation begins again. Really? The temple has to be rebuilt so we can redo sacrifices again? That's what you're going to tell me based from Ezekiel 40 through 48? Really? Oh no, you see, Shane, that's not sacrifices. It's more like the Lord's Supper. It's a memory thing. It's not for atonement. Well, are you going to take the Bible literally or not? Because in Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48, it says these are atonement sacrifices. I've had a premillennial tell me once, in a revelation class on this campus that I was guest teaching at, in the tribulation, the atonement of the cross for the 7 years will be suspended. And I said, that, sir, is borderline heresy. Because nowhere in the Bible do I see that Jesus' sacrifice was forever save 7 years. You see the issue? The issue when you're coming to stuff about dispensational, this isn't just an issue of me saying, well, I think this side of the debate's right, and you say this one, and we're equal side and divided. The problem I have with it, the reason why I've dedicated my life to going against it, is because they're changing the work and the person of Jesus. I have a problem with that. It about made me throw up in the 13th book of the Left Behind series. Whenever in the mouth of Jesus, He describes why they need to start doing sacrifices again. And He associates it very veiled, to atonement. No, I can't ignore all of Hebrews. Sorry. There was one sacrifice for all time. He is our high priest. Sorry, I refuse I refuse to abandon that for a cool little theory that gets me out before everything gets bad. No, not going to happen. So I refuse to engage in predicting. It's foolishness. It does nothing but damage the gospel and the spread of it. Therefore, why would I do it? Because what somebody can say is well, the gospel is still spreading with it. Yeah, in 15 years, whenever your prediction doesn't happen, then what? Then what? Other thoughts, questions, reflections? I wasn't yelling at you, by the way. Just make sure you understand. Yes?
You talk about how, we talked about this in class, like 80% of the time, like prophecy, those words associated with it are not associated with prediction. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of a similar number in reference to the Old Testament, or does it have a higher prediction rate in the Old Testament? And as New Covenant Christians, should we go, predictions have kind of been fulfilled, and we're not really in that mode of understanding of prophecy?
Whenever I was referring to the study of prophecy, prophesying to prophesy, that was a study of the way in which those words are used, Old and New Testament, all the way through. That number is the number for the Bible, not for the New Testament. What was the second half of your question? You said something.
If that's the case, then the second half of my question isn't really.
But what'd you say?
It's kind of like if the number is different for the Old Testament versus the New Testament, being that predictions kind of have been fulfilled from.
Oh.
Are we in a mode of not really caring about prediction as prophecy now?
The only prediction, and this is where even amillennialists would disagree with me. The only prediction that is yet to be fulfilled is Jesus coming back. That's where they'll disagree with me. Because I don't believe in a man of lawlessness. What? Why? Can't I just cut out 2 Thessalonians 2? Because you're assuming 2 Thessalonians 2 is talking about the end of time. If you want to know what I think about 2 Thessalonians 2, I think I have a lecture on it somewhere online, but I'll just tell you my short answer. He's talking about the destruction of the temple. He's telling them, of course Jesus hasn't come back yet. The temple's still standing. We're in 51, not 70. So he uses apocalyptic literature to describe the destruction of the temple using this figure, the man of lawlessness, which seems to look an awful lot like Caligula whenever he was reigning in around 39 to 41. See what I mean? When people will say, well, even Beale and I have had a conversation about this via email. And I just flat out said, well, I'm sorry, I disagree with you. Where he says he believes that before Jesus comes back, it's going to have to get mass persecution really bad to the point where he says, literally, the gospel will almost be snuffed out. And then right before it is, he comes back. And his explanation for that, or where he pulls that from, is 2 Thessalonians 2, and it's in Revelation chapter 20, verses 7 through 10, when the release of Satan. The problem is, and we'll talk about this when we get to Revelation chapter 20, but the very first phrase of Revelation chapter 20, verse 7, is after the 1,000 years. And Beale, like me, normal amillennialist, defined the 1,000 years as the time period between the first coming and the second coming of Christ. Therefore, after the 1,000 years is after the second coming. So you have to explain to me how it gets really bad after the second coming. Or maybe he's using the imagery to communicate something different. We'll talk about that later, which is also my whole PhD dissertation, but we'll get to that at some other point. My point in all this is saying, the only prediction that we need to realize has not been fulfilled is Jesus coming back. Period. No rapture, no great tribulation, no man of lawlessness, no Antichrist. None. Why? Because John even says, the Antichrist is already among you. Read where the words Antichrist actually appear. It's disturbing how much we've created out of this one little image that really pulls most of its information from 2 Thessalonians 2, the man of lawlessness. We've made this whole Antichrist figure, Nikolai Carpathia, walking out and being suave. And problem is, 98% of that is complete fabrication. All you got to do is a word study of Antichrist and then read them in context. What is John saying in the Johannine epistles when he talks about Antichrist? What's he saying? Is he talking about a future figure? Or he says, but the Antichrists are here. Right now among us, first century. So that's where me and a lot of amillennialists will split part, will diverge. Because they, Kim Riddleberger, who wrote A Case for Amillennialism, strong amillennialist, also wrote the book The Man of Sin, I believe, and he argues for a man of lawlessness, which is a typical amillennial perspective. And it makes no sense to me at all. Because I feel like in 2 Thessalonians 2, for some reason, amillennialists have chosen to ignore the genre there, but they actually implement it in Revelation. We're getting really complicated stuff, but I hope you realize what my goal is in talking to you about this is to realize how many different things this actually connects. Because one of the chapters, once the darn book comes, one of the chapters you'll read is my chapter on In Defense of Eschatology. Why I believe that the reason why basically our churches in America are suffering so bad is because we have such bad eschatology. Because eschatology is all about the way you live. It's not about the future. Even the name eschatology is a poor name for it. Last things, study of last things. That's a bad name for it. Because it's a study of what happens in the future in light of what's happened in the past. Therefore, how should you live? Eschatology is all about the present. But it's about ethical living in the present. Hence, chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation. For those that overcome, I know your deeds. Those that overcome, I know your ethical language. It's calling them to a life of living, not a life of predicting. I thought I saw another hand. Somewhere. Any other thoughts, questions, reflections? Want to take a vote if I'm a heretic or not? No. Some other time. Okay. Silent vote. You just voting against me. It's all right. I'm comfortable with that. For even whenever people speak against me because of Jesus' name. I do love Shane Claiborne's response whenever some people in one of my class, they asked him, they said, hey, do you ever get called a heretic? He said, only by heretics. I thought that was funny. Anything else? How you get? Oh, yes, go ahead.
I have a question. Is it really going to do with the rapture?
Good.
In that bit where he was talking about Revelation being set up chiastically, and then I read a little bit, the bit about it in the book too. I was wondering, is the book as a whole, can you break it down chiastically, or is it just a different section?
Some people have
different churches.
Some people have tried. I've not been overly convinced with the chiastic structure for the entire book. There are interesting parallels. Chapter 1, the language that he uses in chapter 1 does seem to surface again in 22. Chapters 21 and 22, because he's describing the New Jerusalem, does make sense with chapters 2 and 3 because they will be a part of the New Jerusalem. So I mean, I'm not saying there aren't parallels, but there are places that you get to and I'm like, you're having to fudge that a little. So I've never been overly convinced. I'm not saying it's not a noble pursuit, and if somebody even wanted to do that, that'd be awesome. I'd love to hear the argument for it. But, and I don't know if I did this on the video or not, but you have to understand even the point of chiasm. Because even the way that we do chiasms normally whenever we're writing it actually misses the Jewish point. Because really the way chiasms work is like this. What is it? That's the way they think. This is the way chiasms make sense to them. It's not point A, point B, point... This makes sense to us because we're linear thinkers. But this is what they're doing. They're bringing you full circle once they get back to A prime. And the point is the middle of the bottom of the circle, the point of the arrow. See what I mean? So even chiasm, it's cyclical thinking. This is the way they think. The way I'm teaching this class is recapitulation. The way that I teach whenever I'm speaking is recapitulation. I to make a point, I say it, and then I pull back and I say it again, and then I come over here and I say it again, and I come over here and it's just what you do. Why? Because that is the way our minds think. Recapitulation, one of the key things that's a benefit of it is repetition. And as a good Jewish rabbi once said, repetition is the mother of all knowledge. You repeat it over and over and over and over and over. We do, and I don't know, again, I don't remember what's in the lecture, so I keep saying I don't know, but we do this at news, in the newscasts. They have a recap of the news, which just is a shortened form of the word recapitulation. So they recap the news. But they have a different purpose when they're recapping, don't they? It's to give you the brevity of it. It's to give you all the highlights all in a row so that you know what they've said. It's everywhere. Matter of fact, the four Gospels, recapitulations. Genesis chapter 1 and 2, recapitulations. Or in 3, recapitulations. It's everywhere. This is not new stuff. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, recapitulations. 1 and 2 Chronicles, 1 and 2 Kings, recapitulations. I mean, hello? You know, Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, recapitulations. It's everywhere. When we come to Revelation, we're like, he's doing something totally new. No, he's not. He's writing like the rest of the Bible. He's recapitulating, saying it over and over and over and over and over. And repetition is the mother of all wisdom. Yes?
Do you have like a structural outline other than what is in Lowry's book?
Of?
Like of the structure of Revelation. Because his outline is just in a... Like a box.
I almost did this for you guys, but I spared you. One of the assignments I was going to have you outline Revelation.
I don't like that sign.
It is impossible. I have my own outline because I've done it. It is brutal, but it's kind of like me saying outline this. That's what it is. You look at a painting, you say outline this for me, please. What does that even mean? How do you do that? You can't. But the problem is, for linear thinkers, you have to. It's a text. Well, it's more of a painting. So my best structure is a picture. It's like this. Actually, sometimes I even reverse it when it's bigger. And then it gets smaller because he does get more finite until he comes to the end. Because he starts way out large. This is the end. And then he comes, this is the end. This is the end. This is the end. This is the end. Satan's destroyed. Yeah. But he's done it several times. So it's easier to do a structure by making a picture of a picture than it is to try and document something that's a picture. You know? Good question, though. And that may sound like a weird answer, but... Yeah. Rationally explain to me art. Okay. Other questions? Thoughts, comments, concerns, fear of where we're headed. Yeah?
Fear of where we're headed.
It's straight to the abyss. Abaddon will be there, I'm sure. The destroyer will come, Apollyon. Okay, where are we headed? Let me describe to you. We have 9 minutes. Not wasting them. We're going to start for the rest of the class on Revelation 1. We are actually not behind. If you look at the schedule, I had a skip day built in. I had 3 catch-up days and question and answer days built in. And we went down from 26 students down to 19. We got time. So... We're now moving into a new capitulation, though, of our class. We started off looking very broad, correct? Yes. Very broad. And yet, and you may not have noticed this, but in all the 8 lectures that you listened to, we actually did, even if it was just a reference, we touched on every chapter of Revelation. You didn't know it, but we did. That's what we were doing. Now what we're going to do is we're going to capitulate again, but it is not going to be as detailed as you want it to be. We are going to go through the text, and I'm going to give you observations and insights. But I'm not going to deal with every issue that's within the text. Why? We're not ready for that yet. Once we get to our final capitulation, in your papers, when we're going through all the chapters, we will be ready to talk about a lot of the nitty-gritty issues. You see what I mean by that? We're easing into this. We're easing through it. We're recapitulating for the purpose of understanding this very complex book. And the reason why it's so complex, hopefully what you got from all the last lectures, is because it comes with so much baggage. But when you start pulling away the baggage, it actually becomes easier. So, as I'm going through the observations, you're going to help me interpret a lot of what we're doing. I'm going to be asking you loads of questions. I'm going to be asking you questions like, what do you notice here? Because I want you to get used to seeing this as a text just like other texts. We're going to do this together. Does that make sense? Okay, so let's begin. Revelation chapter 1, verse 1. We've actually talked quite a little bit about the first three verses already. And you've read quite a little bit in Dr. Lowry's book about the first three verses. It enamored me of how my time at Lincoln, how enamored he was with the first three verses. And you caught that in the book, but that the book is only a hint of the amount of conversations that he brought up the first three verses. And I think the reason, well, we don't need to get into that. Let's start reading. That's always good. The Apocalypse, the revelation of Jesus Christ. What does that say to me right off the bat?
King.
King. What kind of king? A Jewish king. He's making a very kingly Jewish statement in the very first line. Kind of like the book of Matthew begins. The revelation of Jesus the Christ, the King, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. Now, the question a lot of people have is because of the different preposition that connects revelation of Jesus Christ, is this a revelation of him, in other words, about him, or is a revelation from him? Answer, yes. Yes, that is correct. It is of and from. The revelation, because it's about Jesus, but it is coming from Jesus. Right? I can argue the preposition either way. Therefore, let's make it both and. The revelation of and from Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known. What is the word made it known? Actually, signified. Made it known through the use of symbols by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw, that is, the Word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Here's my question. What is he doing for us right off the bat? What is this?
It's an explanation of why he's writing, like how he's writing.
Of exactly, of how. This is almost giving us a genealogy of this letter. Not of John, but of the letter. It comes from, it's a revelation of or from Jesus that came from where? God. Right? That's what he says right off. But who? Okay, so God says, is you start off with God, and it's about Jesus, which also could come from Jesus, so they're kind of par here. And then it goes to where?
Angels.
And then it goes to where?
John.
And then it goes to where?
Churches.
Yeah, churches. And the word he uses here is servants. What he's saying is, this isn't just from John. This starts from the top down. Here's the genealogy of the book of Revelation. God gave it to, about God and Jesus, about Jesus, gave it to the angels to give to John, to give to the servants of God. Particularly, he's going to define it more and more, he's going to recapitulate, and more in detail he's going to tell us it's going to the servants in Asia Minor, which can be by application extended to us. That is, what is it that he's giving? The Word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. We are going to be tracing the word testimony here in a bit. Very important word in the book of Revelation. Testimony, which is what in Greek? Come on, scholars, help me. Martyria. Which also, you have the noun of martyrus, which martyr comes from. Yeah? Verse 3. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy. What does the word prophecy mean? What is it? Who God is, what God desires, and what He demands from us. Is it equal prediction?
Sometimes.
Sometimes, but not the majority. Correct? Because, in a moment right now, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it. What is that word should be translated instead of take to heart?
Obey.
Obey. How do you obey a prediction? Take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. Okay. Notice verse 3, several things about verse 3. Number one, what is it telling me about verse 3, about the audience itself, or about the way in which this letter is delivered? Communally. What else?
Read out loud.
Read out loud. I almost imagine them sitting in their church services and they're going through the different imagery and they say, just close your eyes. And then I was transferred up to heaven and I saw this throne and it was jasper and carnelian and there was an emerald rainbow that was around it and there was four living creatures and inside their mind they're listening to it and it's like a movie playing over in their head. It's a storytelling moment because that's their culture. They don't just sit here and read it and pick apart word by word. They experience it in the same way that people experience art or that people experience a film. Their experience, it's emotionally engaging, cognitively engaging, and ultimately that will be the most effective way to compel them to do something. Blessed are those, not only the one who reads it, but the ones who hear it, but ultimately the ones who obey it. This is the number two, the thing about chapter or verse 3. This is the second out of seven Beatitudes in the book of Revelation. What are Beatitudes? What? Blessed is blah, 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 blah. Blessed is da, 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 da. Let me give you where all seven of them are. Very first one is in Revelation chapter 1, verse 3. Hey, that's the verse we're on. Second one, Revelation chapter 14, verse 13. Third one, Revelation 16, 15. Fourth one, Revelation 19, 9. Fifth one, Revelation 20, verse 6. Sixth one, Revelation 22, 7. Seventh one, Revelation 22, 14. Why seven? Number of completion. You are the complete blessed people if we start off the very first one. If you hear, read, and obey. That sets up the rest of them. Yes?
Is it always the same Greek word in all those?
Yes. Makarios. Yep, yep, yep. And each of them puts a piece to the puzzle of who are the blessed people. Matter of fact, Revelation chapter 14, verse 13 says, blessed are those who die from now on. Oh yeah, it gets beautiful once we get going later. It gets nice and nasty. All right. We have 1 minute, 2 minutes, 0 minutes, but we're going to take one more. Maybe I won't. No, I won't. We'll wait. We're on verse 4. We'll pick up there next Wednesday, God willing, weather permitting. Yeah. Love you guys. You do have a in what chapter next Friday, so hopefully you've been preparing in your slow, snow-ridden lives. We get our own back.